What were some of the bigger trials of your being a father?
Mirrored in this book, our son, our first son, was not a sleeper for about 5 years. And I think we averaged maybe 5 hours a night, not more than 2 hours straight for 4 or 5 years. And somehow my wife stayed employed. She doesn't remember much of it. I wrote a novel. I don't remember much of doing it. But that was the toughest. The rest of it is, even then, I loved it. It was always fun and challenging and cool.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Pete Fromm about his novel, A Job You Mostly Won't Know How to Do. Don't go away. The scenes and the plot of the book carry themselves. And I couldn't help but wonder, you know, the U.S. has one of the highest mortality rates in developed nations, maternal mortality rates. And I was wondering, were you intending to make commentary on this factor? How did this story come to you?
The fact that the U.S., which should not have one of the highest maternal death rates in the world, was definitely in my mind. The story came to me. I've got a low-res teaching gig at Pacific University in Oregon. So I'm out there two weeks a year. And a student came and slapped a copy of Glimmer Train against my chest. And he's this big fireman guy, and he's macho. And he says, read this story at the hospital and tell me if I'm a baby for crying. And so I read it, and it's about a guy who's the couple's in the hospital for months. His wife has a very risky pregnancy, and he's got to deal with her parents. And the story ends with him walking out of the hospital with his baby, and his wife has died. That was a great ending for the story. Mm-hmm. But I thought, oh, but man, that's the beginning of another huge story, this guy then going home with the baby. And so I started the next day writing from that scene forward. Totally different guy, you know, but just that idea of coming home with a baby without the mother.
The chapters move quickly and are titled by the days and months on either side of this baby's birth. And I was taught that time stamping things is not always an effective way of flagging movement for the readers, but there's something about it that made sense to me. But I wanted to hear from you. How did you decide on that for the structure and for the pacing?
For the structure, I just thought that the day of the baby's birth was going to be so central but also catastrophic to this Taz, the father, that he would tend to think it's been this long since then. And as the couple, Marnie and Taz, are looking forward to that day, it's also going to be a huge marker. We've got this much till the baby's born. And so it just kind of grew from that. I'll never do it again because through the years of rewriting, when sections would be added, I'd have to try to go back and calibrate the days, and I completely blew it. In the copy edits, the publishers finally said, you know, it says this is day 130, but if Christmas is an anchor, this is actually not accurate. And so there's been, my publisher says he'll never take out another book that's dated this way. But I think it works for the book, but it was a mess to deal with.
Yeah. You've mentioned Taz, and I want us to be able to talk about the characters, but we can't get into talking about the characters without talking about their names. So we have Taz, Midge, Elmo. It started to make me wonder, what alternate name reality are you living in?
My wife is from Butte, and everybody in Butte has a nickname.
Yeah.
It's I've met guys there that I've heard about for 20 years, and they're introduced as John, and I've never heard of him. And, oh, yeah, he's Goo.
Right.
And, oh, okay. And Taz was named for the Tasman Sea, or nickname for that. His real name is Ted. Elmo is a young woman with bright red hair and big eyes, so she was named in middle school, probably not kindly,
right.
As one of the Muppets. And Midge isn't a nickname. That's the name they decided to give the child.
Will you take us to the scene of the naming?
Sure. This novel set in Missoula, and the Blackfoot is one of the several rivers that come together in town. And if you drive far enough up the Blackfoot, the North Fork comes down out of the Scapegoat Mountains in the Bob Marshall Wilderness. Marnie, Taz's wife, and Taz and Marnie have a favorite spot up on the North Fork of the Blackfoot. They go up there when she's very pregnant. She calls it giving the baby swimming lessons. And so they've been in the water a long time and talked about whether it's going to be a boy or a girl. And she says, it's going to be a girl. There's no sweat. I know that. And then I'll read after that. They're still at the North Fork. They dry raisin style in the sun, then dress and pick their way upstream. The water's so low in the drought that they crunch over whitened cobble they'd never before seen dry. When they reach the wall of the last little canyon, Marn flashes Taz a look, a question, and he glances down at her belly, raises an eyebrow. Sacagawea carried her baby all the way to the Pacific and back, Marnie says, and she goes first, stepping up onto the foot-wide ledge of cracked and crumbling stone. She clings to the rock, a root here and there, some wild bit of buffalo brush taking seed in the rock, cracking its way in. Below them, the river, channeled tight, races through the drop, split by boulders, and Taz follows inches behind, ready to grab, to dive in after her. But they make it through, dropping from rock to bunch grass, the little meadow, the canyon he keeps hidden, and they stroll through the brittle stems, scattering grasshoppers all the way up to the beaver ponds. Water trickles through the bulwark of sticks and mud, the first pond glassy beyond it. They catch their breath, set up their rods, and Marnie, looking around for any kind of a hatch, runs her fingers across the flies in her box, pulls out a tiny one, a midge, and names it out loud. Digging through his own fly box, Taz says, maybe, but I think a hopper can't miss. No, Marnie says, Midge. That's what we'll call her. Her name. Midge? Yeah, just this tiny thing, but what sort of holds the whole deal together. Really? She smiles. It's perfect. The food chain? You want her at the bottom of the food chain? That is so not perfect. She looks at him. And you're going to explain that to her later. Yeah, geez, honey, we just wanted, you know, for you to be at the slaughter end, what the whole world preys on. Her look narrows. Well, come on, Marn. If you want to go all native, how about, I don't know, cutthroat? That'd be cool. Make the other kids leave her alone. Or otter, maybe. She squints down towards Scary, and Taz says, or, you know, Midge is good.
So you've mentioned Elmo, this red-haired, big-eyed woman. And I want to know where this character came from for you. She feels very Montana.
Yeah, she is. And as I said before, my wife grew up in Butte, so I've been surrounded with her and her six sisters. Montana, or just, she's pretty confident with who she is. She's fairly tough and is a little bit nervous. Taz's friend Rudy finds her and says, could you babysit so this guy can go back to work? And she knows the situation she's moving into, and she's pretty tentative, but not cowed. She's just like, yeah, I can't do that.
And for the listeners, I'll just say that she worked at a bar. She's raised her siblings. She owns a fixer-upper house herself, and she's a college student doing her student teaching at some point. She's an endearing character, but I wanted to know how you walked the line between her being neither too adolescent nor too grown up, because she's taking on a mothering role.
Yeah, that was tough. She's still an undergrad. She's probably about 22. She's taken a few years off. As you said, her parents divorced, and she got to raise the second brood. And so she was used to the work. But the finest line to tiptoe around was the fact that now there's a young woman with this really heartbroken guy, and as the sexual tension starts to build, was to keep that from falling over the line, because if that happens, the story falls apart.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because part of what kept the read going so quickly was I was like, oh no, is there going to be the babysitter trope, you know?
Exactly.
And I mean, you scraped the guardrail a couple times. And I want to know more about that process of keeping yourself in check and keeping the story, because there is a romantic build.
Right. The scraping the guardrail, that's a pretty good way to put it. At first he barely even notices her, and as she tries to pull him out of his world of loss, it gets to be where she's almost mothering him as well and saying, you know, you got to snap out of it. You got to do this for Midge. And as he starts to recover and sees around him, he's already leaning on her so much for what she's doing for Midge and for him, that they're like a couple, mm-hmm. except they're not. And that she's afraid to get into it, not really knowing enough about him and how far he can recover. And he's just can't. He feels like that would be unfaithful to Mark. And so it's both of them are resisting, and the attraction grows through that. But I can't have them get together. And so I kept trying to keep them apart. And just as their story progressed, it started to see, it seemed like at some point that might happen. And so I wrote to find out, but kind of was saying, but you can't.
Right. You had that same amount of sort of curiosity and resistance in you.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Which is usually true. I'm usually writing to find out what's going to happen to these people.
Right.
And sometimes when characters do things, when they do things you don't expect, that means it's going well. But when they do things you don't want them to do, then you're like, well, I don't, you know, okay, that's not only unexpected, but geez, you know, you can't do that. But sometimes that is what they're going to do. And then I have to figure out how to live with it.
It sounds like you give your characters some level of autonomy or respect. You honor their wishes.
Yeah, I mean, I probably spent 6 years working with these guys. And so, you know, you want to respect them enough to want to hang out with them
right.
for 6 years. And I was talking the other day about hope in a story, and this was for a previous book where a woman has MS, and I said, "Well, what do you have if you don't have hope?" And then you just have a capitulation story, and what interest is that to anyone? And so, even though Taz has been laid pretty low, I hoped that he would come out of it.
Right.
And for the early drafts, I set it away for a year or two because it was so miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just ruined. And when Rudy brought Elmo over saying, here's somebody who can help you, that's sort of where that first ray of, okay, maybe we'll get out of this.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Pete Fromm about his novel, A Job You Mostly Won't Know How to Do. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Describe Rudy.
He's like a lot of my friends. He's kind of a knucklehead. He's got no real big league ambitions. He works high work, tower work, cleaning wind turbines, changing light bulbs, and giant antennas. And it pays well, and he does just enough of it to keep going. Likes to go down to the Missoula bars, likes to go fishing, and he's with Marnie and Taz when they're doing the demo work on their house. He's over to help, beer in one hand, a sledgehammer in the other. And so he's easy to sort of dismiss, but he's the guy that will, he's going to do anything. They've been friends since grade school, and he's deeper than it looks on the surface.
I was going to say that there are parts in reading the scenes that Rudy shows up in, and I was like waiting for him to really mess up. But he doesn't. He sort of just stays this kind of goofball, good-hearted guy. And that's what it made me want to know who Rudy is to you. And it sounds like he's in part some of your good buddies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've definitely failed to launch. I got out of college and then just sort of, I was working part-time as a park ranger, and I just come back to Missoula and live with the same crew of guys who were not really setting the world on fire right after graduation. And so it was sort of, I knew those people.
I was thinking about how you also navigated roles, because Elmo comes in and she's not only doing the parenting and mothering, but she starts doing the bookkeeping and taking on sort of these classic paternal roles, and then Rudy is pretty nurturing too. So how did you figure out, who gets to be masculine and who gets to be feminine? And
I never really thought of it in that kind of a stereotypical way. It was more, what did Taz need? Yeah. And Taz just wasn't paying bills, because that was Marnie had always done that. And he didn't really know how, he wasn't interested, and every time he'd start, it would take him back to having Marnie doing it. And so somebody had to, and Rudy started saying, you're going to lose the house. And then Elmo said, I can do that. I'll just take over. And she does more of that after Marn dies. He barely eats. He doesn't really even see the point. He has no appetite. And so she starts making food, shopping. Rudy pays for the food at first because he doesn't have anything. And so they're just this team that comes together kind of on their own, saying, we got to keep this guy alive long enough so he reboots.
Yeah.
And they filled whatever roles needed filling.
Right. I'm going to add, the maybe fourth wheel, which is Lauren, Marnie's mother, Taz's mother-in-law. And I just want to know more about how you navigated Taz and Lauren not competing over grief.
Right. That was a long battle. In earlier drafts, Taz and Marnie made vicious fun of her mother. And the mother was a single mom raising this Marnie. And so they fought during the adolescent years. And it was a running joke about what a pain she was. And in the earlier drafts, Taz just kept up with that, but it turned dark. He really resented almost everything she did. And it was so... as the novel, the beginning parts of them teasing her got left behind. And so Taz's behavior with the mother seemed really nasty. And so I had to rework her. And as I started doing that, she started to come into her own much more. Instead of, I was really wary of making the stereotypical, mother-in-law figure. And so I was like, no, she's real and she is suffering greatly herself. She's lost her daughter and she doesn't live in Montana. So she's trying to cling to some hold to this grandchild. And Taz became a much bigger part of the story of Taz trying to let her in, but not have her move in and like take over this life he's trying to rebuild.
Pete, once I attended a reading where you read about a couple after a school shooting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about this book and some of your other work. And where does this darkness come from?
I think it's a tragic case of what if. I've been so lucky in my whole life. My parents stayed together. They raised six kids in middle class. I blundered into coming out to Montana. I blundered into Bill Kittredge's writing class. I found out what I wanted to do. And so I think I always wonder, well, what if? I'm not thinking, well, what if that hadn't happened to me? But just thinking, well, what if you had something going on and then some big roadblock came? And that's sort of where stories come from. It's you crank something up by making it the day that a friend of mine describes plot as being, then things got worse.
Yes.
And I think, well, that the story of the school shooting I wrote right after the Newtown shooting and just, so overwhelmed with the idea of sending a sixth grader or six-year-old off to school and having him shot. And how that would affect the survivors, which is much the same in this book. Is if you're going to the hospital to have your baby, and then you come home without your wife, and then what? And so, what if? And then what? So maybe I pick some of the grimmer things, but I want to see people and how they regroup and rise above. And how you can go into something that's so difficult and come out of it, I don't know if better is the right word, but, transformed and not just surviving, but making something new.
Is this why you're so popular in France?
Who knows why I'm popular in France? Again, the luck thing. There was 10 or 12 years ago, there was a disgruntled chief financial officer in a big company in France who always had loved Western American literature. So he quit his job, started his own publishing company, and one of the first books he picked up was Indian Creek Chronicles. And he flew me over to France. We met. We've become really good friends. And he's an old school publisher in that he gets an author and he builds up their reputation. So I've been to France 10 or 12 times since then. And simply through promotion and this hard work of touring people around and making sure their reputation builds. And the readership over there is very different. If they like one of your books, they'll read them all. And it doesn't matter if one's Indian Creek Chronicles about a guy living in the wilderness, nonfiction, right, or the story about a guy whose wife dies in childbirth. They're into it. Mm-hmm. And so it's been his work that has really made that happen. But it's a blast. It's like, after all this time, I've got a career. It's in a different country, but still.
11 books in 20 years. What does the writer's landscape look like to you now?
As far as...
Where are you going? I mean, how does it feel to have been where you've been?
It feels pretty much the same. I mean, it is, you know, I go into my office every day and think, well, what if? What now? How are these guys going to, you know, get in out of whatever they're into? And, you know, when books haven't sold, I just keep writing, start the next one. And been lucky again that most of them have sold at some, you know, eventually. As far as the business side of it, it's just harder and harder, I think, to sell anything, to get it out, to have, you know, people notice it. And it's a very different landscape than it used to be. Book tours were usually put on, and you'd run around and you'd have some fun. You'd read to a lot of crowds of two or three. Yeah. And now they're figuring those don't really work that well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see the opposite is true in France.
Right.
And it's just, there's just so much out there competing for everything. So I tell students that if you're going to do this for 30 years, that you've got to get your reward from the writing itself. You know, I get really jazzed if I have a scene that's been hard. You know, I can't quite figure out how it's going to come together. And when it does, I mean, I can barely even sit down at my computer. I'm standing typing, like, yes, this is, and it's got to come from that, because the publishing life is totally divorced from the writing life, and it's brutal, and it can be, and lightning can strike, and you can't plan on lightning striking. So it's, you know, if you could enjoy the writing and just living in other people's lives, which I find that's what fascinates me the most. You just don't have to be your same old boring self. And so, you know, I've been asked by financial advisors when I plan to retire, and it just cracks me up. It's like when do you plan on no longer thinking?
Right.
And so, you know, I do it every single day. I love doing it. So I've been lucky to get some sort of career here and then a whole rebirth in Europe.
Pete Fromm lives in Missoula, Montana. He's a five-time winner of the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Literary Award and is the author of 5 short story collections, 5 novels, and 2 memoirs. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.